The MORE Act is flawed. It uses cannabis policy to do a great deal of social engineering, to create new taxes and new programs and redistribution of assets. But I am here as the only Republican co-sponsor of the MORE Act, and I'm voting for it. Because the federal government has lied to the people of this country about marijuana for a generation. We have seen a generation, particularly of black and brown youth, locked up for offenses that should have not resulted in any incarceration whatsoever. I'm also deeply troubled that the current policy of the federal government inhibits research into cannabis, research that could unlock cures and help people live better lives.
That was a righteous Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz on Friday slamming his Republican colleagues in the House for voting overwhelmingly against the historic and narrowly approved Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act, or MORE, because they can't do it without doing that stuff. That act repealed the federal ban on marijuana, or at least is trying to, that we've had now for 83 years. Hello, everyone. Happy Monday, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by my presumably sober Reason colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Salutations, comrades.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hi, Matt.
So we're going to get into some libertarian disagreements or libertarian adjacent disagreements over the pot bill. But first, we are in the final countdown stage of Reason's annual webathon, people. The gong sounds at midnight on Tuesday, so set your clocks accordingly. Things are going super great so far because of your generosity. We've blasted through our initial $200,000 target, and we're already, I think, at the third highest level in our 13 years of doing this stuff. But I would sure love to be even more greedy and see more individuals donate, regardless of what level. It's super teeny tiny fine. Remember that this is part of the way that we kind of build in institutional resilience. It's just the sheer number of donors to us during the webathon and elsewhere means that you just, you know, there can't be a single person with a single monocle telling us what to do. So if you're listening to this, which you are, and you haven't yet ponied up even a token amount, please stop, just hit pause, go to reason.com, donate, and let the sweet, sweet swag wash over you. You'll be glad you did. Later in the show, we're going to hopefully get to some overflow listener emails that we didn't have time to address in our very special video webathon response midweek thingy that we did last week, and et cetera. Okay, sorry for that commercial up the top. And let's go to Friday. On Friday, Congress voted 228-164 with just five Republicans joining that majority, as well as Libertarian Justin Amash, to remove cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act and eliminate federal criminal penalties associated with the demon weed, and also require automatic expungement of federal pot convictions. The bill is not expected to be taken up by the Senate as long as Mitch McConnell runs the place. He said last week, quote, "The House of Representatives is spending this week on pressing issues like marijuana, you know, serious, important legislation benefiting the national crisis," unquote. It sounded just like that. Catherine, I want to get into that line of argumentation a little bit later. But first, I want you, as the editor in chief of Reason Magazine, to address some of the kind of libertarian world sort of disputes over the bill. Thomas Massie, no stranger to listeners and readers, viewers of Reason, voted no, saying, quote, "I wish Speaker Pelosi was serious about repealing the federal prohibition on marijuana. I could cross the aisle to vote on it if it weren't being used as a vehicle to pass new taxes and spending," unquote. As our resident anarchist, Catherine, what do you say to people who argue against the legalization of marijuana on grounds that it will expand government?
I, in my charitable moments, do have some sympathy for this view. I get it that this feels like a moment when we can get this right or we can get this wrong, and that it's important to try as hard as we can to get this right. That said, you know what would be not getting this right? to not do it at all. And that is a thing that we're genuinely risking here. In fact, probably we won't do it at all this time for a bunch of reasons, but the idea that the greater harm being done here would be a slightly too high rate of taxation on marijuana is so blinkered. And plenty of people have taken Massey to task for this, including several recent staffers on Twitter. But the harm being done by the war on drugs is, in fact, what Matt Gaetz said. I don't always find myself saying like that Matt Gaetz, he's really onto something. But in this case, he is. He is totally correct that the life ruining effects of the war on drugs, especially for people of color, but for so many people in this country, to no good end, is the thing that we need to focus on and solve first.
Nick, you have been relishing the idea of divided government in these recent weeks, as a lot of us have been doing. That would require both Georgia runoff elections in the Senate to be won by Republicans. Here's what one of those Republican candidates, Kelly Loeffler, tweeted out on December 1st. Quote, "Rent is due today, and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are focusing on legalizing marijuana and outlawing the Tiger King. Spare us the gaslighting." So question for you, Nick. If divided government is the only obstacle to legalizing marijuana on the federal level, do you still want the Republicans to win those races?
Well, you know, first I want to get some of whatever Kelly Loeffler is smoking. I think she's taking some kind of maintenance dose of a low-level hallucinogen.
Salvia,
and I'm all for that. Yeah, probably. You know,
just writing her congressman on salvia.
But you know, this—that's a great question to ask, Matt. Like, if divided government is the only thing standing in the way of getting marijuana off of the federal register, you know, is that worth getting rid of it? I don't know about that, because it's always more than that. But what we do know is that in this current moment, people like Thomas Massey, who lays claim, a rightful claim to being libertarian, when Justin Amash goes, he will be the sole libertarian, like seriously libertarian-leaning candidate or congressman. It is, I think, shameful that he did not vote in favor of this law, especially knowing that it was not going to be taken up because of his fellow Kentuckian, Mitch McConnell, to kind of be dancing on the head of a pin about this will raise taxes or this will increase government spending because it opens up certain types of programs to more participation by people, especially people whose marijuana convictions have been expunged, is just ridiculous. And this is one of the reasons why throughout all of the talk about how unpopular Donald Trump was, Congress always had a much, much lower approval rating because they're bullshit artists. And they're not doing what 68% of Americans in the latest polls want marijuana to be legalized. This is the easiest slam dunk in the world. And it's shameful that people that you know, all but five Republicans voted against this. And I want to give a shout out to actually to California's own Tom McClintock, who's, you know, started his a congressman who voted in favor of it. He is a guy whose political journey from being a kind of, you know, really hard right conservative culture warrior in Congress to being something much more thoughtful and much more libertarian. He's still conservative. He voted for it. If he could vote for it, people like Tom Massey could. And I want to also point out just that Justin Amash had as many reservations as Massey had, and he voted for it, meaning that the Libertarian Party is the only party that had 100% of its people voting in favor of marijuana legalization. And let's, you know, again, putting this, you know, in perspective, this is a case where I think there is a strain of libertarian nihilism in policy discussions, where if everything is not exactly perfect and it's not against the backdrop of getting rid of government, doing everything, then I'm going to vote against it. That is a defeatist attitude, and it allows for all kinds of posturing that is just really untenable in the current moment.
Peter, speaking of California congressmen with Mick in their last names, Bakersfield's pride, Kevin McCarthy, the GOP leader, said the following.
A young gun.
Oh, dear God.
He's the last young gun in office.
He's a cap gun.
Wow.
A 70s cap gun at best. Sorry, Kevin. didn't mean to hit you there. Not sorry. Anyways, he said the following last week, quote, small businesses are closing, Americans are getting laid off, and Democrats are voting on checks notes marijuana. They are picking weed over workers, unquote. I would like, Peter, you as the residence process person here, to cogitate for a moment on the very common Republican objection to this, which is, hey, don't we have more important things that we should be working on?
So for one thing, that's funny, given that Mitch McConnell spent the entire summer basically saying, well, you know, I don't know about this coronavirus thing. Maybe we need a relief bill at some point. We'll reassess in the future. I just don't know. We're going to get there. So if their idea is, and I'm not saying this is the right idea, but if their idea is that what Congress should be focusing on is a coronavirus relief bill, a big spending package, then it's their guy, Mitch McConnell, who spent the entire summer holding that up. Now, I also just think it's a completely false dichotomy, right? The idea that Congress can only work on one thing is not true. It's just that Congress often chooses to only work on one thing, or when, for example, the House chooses to work on one thing because Democrats want to work on it and Republicans don't want to work on that thing, their argument is, well, we should be working on this other thing and not that at all. But it's Congress can do multiple things at once when they want to. It's just that they don't want to. There's a disagreement right now between the House and the Senate, which are controlled by Republicans and Democrats. I do want to get back to the Young Guns thing. It's important. It's because it's really a great Western movie series starring Emilio Estevez and Kiefer Sutherland. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lou Diamond Phillips and Christian Slater. It's really,
Casey,
I mean, it's
incredible.
Actually, what I really want to talk about just briefly is the Massey tweet, because it's crazy. The logic of that, of the idea that we shouldn't end prohibition on marijuana, suggests that we should not have ended prohibition on alcohol. So in Massey's home state of Kentucky, where they make bourbon, there is a $1.92 excise tax per gallon of spirits produced. There is an 11% wholesale tax on spirits. That's a lot higher than the taxes on wine and beer. On beer, for example, it's just 8 cents per gallon. By Massey's logic, that because alcohol production is taxed in his home state, Kentucky should just go ahead and wipe out the spirits production industry and go back to prohibition. That's crazy. It's a completely stupid way of looking at marijuana prohibition.
Well, I'd like to add that Justin Amash, in his public comments about this, lamented, as did Massey, that Nancy Pelosi did not allow for the offering of amendments. In fact, no Speaker of the House in several years running have really allowed new amendments to active bills on the floor. This is a consistent process objection, and it's a correct one, I believe, that Amash has had, that is part of Congress handing over its power chunk by chunk, not even drip by drip, over the past few years. Catherine, I've seen a lot of people, speaking of spirits, a lot of people in the sort of Jacob Greer verse, those who Jacob wrote a long essay just before the election saying, here's why I'm a libertarian voting for Joe Biden. And part of it was like, you know, a Republican Party under Trump, just, you know, knock it off. There isn't any severe or serious footholds for a libertarian or freedom friendly message in there. So I've seen a lot of people, including Jacob and others, hold up this vote as like the final aha. This was a futile project to try to grow, or, you know, to bet on this team being more friendly to libertarianism than not. Do you agree with that, or what's your opinion on that as a takeaway from this vote?
Yeah, I think that certainly looking at stuff like that Massey tweet, I get the despair. I really do. And I think, you know, I've felt the same in response to much of Rand Paul's recent tweeting and general behavior. The idea that there are these people who we know have at times in the past furthered a libertarian agenda in their roles in Congress and who seem to have lost their way is super frustrating. And as always, people tend to be extra angry when someone they thought there was that was their friend turned out not to be as simpatico with them as they hoped, rather than people who they always kind of knew were in opposition. I guess my feeling, though, is just to not lose perspective on the fact that Democrats are also not good on lots of things that are important to us. And I know that that sounds sort of overly simplified or kind of very basic, but it is hard to keep perspective on that. You know, when Massey is out here saying, I can't vote for this bill that would genuinely dramatically improve the lives of many, many people by expanding personal freedom in a very important way and maximizing bodily autonomy for millions and millions of people because taxes, it's frustrating, but it is still coming from a place of because taxes. And I think sometimes you're going to get Democrats who will flip that, but it's not, you know, we don't have to choose a side. This is the thing that I just feel and believe so deeply, that it is the wrong question to say which side will be better aligned with us or which side will treat us better, which side will take our concerns more seriously. It is the wrong question. They're both bad. Both of the major parties are genuinely bad for personal freedom. Thomas Massey gave us a great little object lesson about that this week, but a Democrat will do it next week. Someone that we fundamentally agree with on, for instance, the need for criminal justice reform will say, but first, in order to do that, we have to bring about climate justice. And that will be wrong in the same way. It will be a confusion of order of operations and priorities. And they are, both parties are wrong in this way from a libertarian perspective, and it should be fine to simply say that and to say we don't have to choose a side.
Part of what drives me so nuts on this is that it really should be a bipartisan issue. If you look at the latest polling from Pew, you see that virtually everyone who isn't really, really old supports legalizing marijuana. So you have a majority of Democrats, like a very large majority. That's pretty not surprising, but also a majority of people who are Republican or lean Republican, a majority of men, a majority of women, a majority of every polled racial group. The only group of people who consistently oppose marijuana legalization are the silent generation. That's people who are older than 75, which happens to include quite a large number of Republican, like senior Republican legislators, and Democrats as well, including our future president, Joe Biden. But it's just the really olds who are the holdouts at this point. And Republicans just aren't kind of coming along with this in a way that I think doesn't even really make political sense for them. And for better, or perhaps in some ways for worse, the Matt Gaetz position, and Matt Gaetz, in a lot of ways, is the future of the Republican Party. And I think, you know, that yes, I see Catherine, like, Catherine's face is extremely gif-able right here.
Face.
But his righteous monologue was righteous. And I think that we will see more of that from Republicans over time. But it's just very frustrating that it's taken so long and that we're not seeing more of it now.
There is, you know, Rand Paul actually said that, you know, he thinks his colleagues both in the Senate and in the House are stuck, you know, that they watched Reefer Madness in the theaters when they were kids because they're that old and that they never saw anything after that. And I think
me too, but it was
in
a revival theater. It's a double feature,
right?
With
this is
2001
not in the 30s. Yeah.
It was like a Rocky Horror Picture Show type situation.
Even the Republican, there are currently two Republican senators from Colorado that'll change next year, but they were split on this. And, you know, Colorado is the state that is leading the way in, you know, positive, well-regulated, well-structured, good, responsible legalization of marijuana. And, you know, so there was a Republican there, Cory Gardner, who got voted out. You know, the Republican Party is acting totally a fool on this, because the whole point of marijuana legalization, like we know now from all of the states that have legalized it for recreational and medical problems, medical use, it does not increase problems. It is an intoxicant like beer, wine, and alcohol. People use it responsibly. It reduces crime. It reduces problems. It enhances the psychological health of the people who use it overall. The Republican Party says that it stands for individual responsibility and getting the government out of people's lives. For the Republican Party en masse in the House to vote against this is just reprehensible. And it will, as Peter was saying, it's going to hurt them for years to come because they already have a youth problem. And this only cements that, these are people who are out of touch.
The rest of Gaetz's speech was actually pretty good, too. Obviously, we couldn't play the whole thing at the top of this pod, but he goes into some stuff about, like, well, if you care about the opioid epidemic, let's talk about how marijuana legalization interacts with that. Like, he gave a speech that, in theory, any Republican could have given at any time in the last 20 years. It was consistent with the stated principles of the party. And the fact that Republicans have chosen not to give that speech for the last 20 years is deeply frustrating. It's not a pivot of principle. It's just a pivot of application. And Massey, like, accidentally double pivoted. Like, he saw the application and then, like,
I think he was high.
This seems...
He was
very
either high or
like
drunk
a,
when
like
he said that.
Ice skating commentary?
He did a triple sow cow of policy analysis and landed on his butt. And it sucks because I would have liked to see him stick the landing. But
Catherine, you're really right when you say that, this is not a reason to say, oh, well, you know what? We got to go with Joe Biden because we know Joe Biden, is a real friend of personal freedom or the libertarians who are talking up Joe Biden now is insane.
I mean, this is one of the issues that Biden has had the most trouble coming around on. And he has shifted in a better direction, but he still seems really quite wary of legalizing
marijuana.
Are
you saying that he's a rusty weather vane?
Matthew Lee.
Before we leave the topic, there's a tick, and Catherine, maybe you should address this. There's a tick in commentary about marijuana to this day. It shocks me that it still lasts, but I'll give you an example in a moment. I recall 10 years ago when California was trying to bum rush the recreational legalization of marijuana, which is quite the startling move. I used to chronicle all of the ridiculous California newspaper editorials against it, especially in the way that they would say things like, what are they smoking? They would like literally put reefer madness in the headline. I remember Arnold Schwarzenegger back then was saying, we can't do this because we become a laughing stock. So with that as a backdrop, Catherine, the website Liberty Hangout tweeted this following thing. The marijuana decriminalization, scare quote bill, will create new federal agencies and impose new taxes on our country. I don't know about you guys, but making a few potheads happy isn't worth giving the feds more power. What is that?
I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts about Liberty Hangout. I don't actually. I have just one thought, which is like, what are they smoking?
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
But we always go back.
It should be Liberty Hot Box.
We always
Liberty
go back
Hot
to the potheads.
Box.
We always go back to the, Julie Borowski said, do libertarians love marijuana or hate taxes more? I hate marijuana. Or I don't like it. I can't smoke it. It's not about
you
that.
You only smoke it every
but
time
other than
it's
that,
offered
he hates it.
To you.
Yeah, I mean, I think.
That's because you've never had Catherine's one bowl pot brownies.
So good. So delicious and so effective. Okay, so here's the thing. I think it does point to, we've talked a little bit on this podcast about how it used to be a sort of good shorthand to say socially liberal, fiscally conservative, and that now both of those terms have kind of come unmoored from what they meant in the 80s and 90s when that phrasing was more commonly used. This is a great example of how you can kind of misprioritize the importance of the fiscal conservatism piece. Like, it is hugely important. It is super important. And again, just to be super clear, my position on these issues is 1, no taxes at all. 2, no prohibition at all. Like, that's where I'm starting from. But if you're trying to get to more personal freedom, fewer bad consequences, fewer lives ruined, It's just so clear that there is no way that you can interpret legalizing and taxing marijuana as expanding federal power. That is a deep misunderstanding of where federal power touches people's lives. And there are millions of people in this country for whom marijuana prohibition has had life-ruining consequences for themselves, for people they know. And that's why the poll results that Nick cited earlier are happening. That is why people are saying, hey, maybe this isn't a good idea. Maybe this stuff shouldn't be illegal. It sure seems like we are disproportionately punishing people who do this thing that doesn't otherwise have very many bad social consequences. And that's not really what government is supposed to be about. So, yeah, I genuinely struggle to see how you could explicitly say this is a bad trade-off in terms of federal power. I can see how you could say, as I think Massey was trying to say, there would be a better way to do this, and I want to hold out for the better way. I think he's wrong, but that at least makes a little bit of sense to me. What doesn't make sense to me is the notion that legalizing and taxing marijuana would be an expansion of state power. It's simply not.
There's a version of the, perfect enemy good marijuana problem policy that happens in New York always, which is that you would think New York would have, if you don't know much about New York, let's say, you would think that, the decadent enclave would have legalized it decades ago. But in fact, it's the love for taxation and redistribution that gets in the way of it, because they will say, well, you know, we could legalize it, but we need to make guarantee that the new business is like majority minority owned to help redress past imbalances and all these. And so they stack up all of these requirements of what a legal regime has to look like, which is to say a totally kind of government directed progressive economics. And then it gets complicated and then it gets voted down. So the left wing obstacles to ending prohibition are plentiful as well. And also based in some bad ideas. We're going to get to some coronavirus policy news here in a second. But first, December can be brutal for everything: depression, stress, anxiety, unexplained monoliths. Luckily for you, our friends at betterhelp.com/roundtable offer an easy-to-use gateway to professional, confidential help tailor-made to your specific needs and technological specs. That's betterhelp.com, H-E-L-P, like help. Gives you instant access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. Go to their website, betterhelp.com/roundtable. Describe confidentially the problems you seek to address, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like the first guy or gal, you'll get another one right away. Financial assistance is also available. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, Peter, why does England have a vaccine and we don't?
Because their health authorities decided that it was a priority and ours decided they'd like to take Thanksgiving off. No, so it's a little more complicated than that, but in some ways that's kind of it. The FDA has been working on reviewing the documents that Pfizer provided in their application, which was sent in November 22nd for the first of the vaccine. So that's the Pfizer vaccine, which is based on this messenger RNA technology that's really quite new and interesting and innovative. And the FDA does appear to be working a little faster than usual on this. This is a process that normally would take many, many months, and the FDA is set to finish it in just a matter of weeks. A matter of weeks is still way too slow and completely unnecessary. And the thing that you need to understand with this is that that is the way it always is with the FDA. The FDA is a slow-moving, moribund bureaucracy that just gets in the way of life-saving medical innovation all the time. And now, normally that just affects a relatively small group of patients who may be sympathetic, but aren't, you know, everyone in the world, or at least everyone in the country. So a lot of it goes overlooked, or at least kind of there's just this low-level argument happening in the background all the time. But this is the most urgent and pressing public health crisis in a century. In the U.S. alone, 2,000 people a day are dying. The FDA Got these documents, like I said, November 22nd, and they scheduled a review meeting for December 10th. They did not look at the documents on a rolling basis, which is what they do in the UK. They basically said, we'll wait for you to finish, send your stuff in, we'll go through it, we'll have a meeting at the time that we have a meeting on. Do the math. 2,000 people a day are dying. What does a 1 week delay cost, or a 2 week delay? The FDA is costing people's lives here. And I think it's incredibly objectionable. It's unconscionable. And yet it's also exactly what the FDA does all the time.
Yeah. I mean, this is
Catherine.
I was going to say that this is, to me, like, if people take one thing away from us, like, quote unquote, losing this race, right? Like, people are competitive. Like, people are competitive for their nation. If, you know, the UK did it first, got there first, and Americans are mad because we're losing, just like Americans are always mad that we're, like, losing to China on things, whatever. Like, why did we lose? We lost because our drug approval system is really broken. We are also losing on cancer drugs. We are also losing on every kind of drug for exactly this same reason. And it's just that normally people are privately suffering individually, and we just happen to be suffering collectively as a nation right now. It's such a good moment to be like, this is not how to do it. The FDA is so broken. And I think, you know, the thing that I keep thinking about is, in addition to the demands of our bureaucracy, there's also the demands of science, right? Like, what we've learned is that these vaccines were actually formulated very early. Like, all of these drug companies had the actual vaccine worked out. Like, they had a vial of this stuff in their labs months ago. And of course you have to test it. Of course you have to test it, right? You can't be like, we're pretty sure this is good to go, let's start injecting it into people. That is not how we do things, and that's correct. There is a scientific approach to this that we have all agreed upon. But we have to make as much space as possible to do the science, as little space as possible to do the bureaucracy. Like, the science, while the science was happening, lots of people died, and it was unavoidable. But this thing, these 2 weeks, but also the misinformation before that and all kinds of other things, those were avoidable. Like, you can fix a bureaucracy. You have to do science, but you can fix a bureaucracy. And my God, could we try after this, please?
Yeah, the FDA has been a bad actor throughout this process, and it has really exposed just not how corrupt or how, you know, sort of intentionally evil or whatever the FDA is. No, just kind of how...
Or incompetent.
How
yeah.
awful they are. How slow moving, how inept. I mean, like, there was a part of the process earlier in the year where they were developing the test kits, and the CDC, this started at the CDC, which and then moved up to the FDA, and the CDC just botched the initial round of test kits. They sent out bad test kits. And because the system is set up so that the CDC has to make the first test kits and nobody else can make test kits that work, we lost about a month in the testing race. And the FDA didn't approve private testers, which is what they have used in Europe, right? And so the CDC and the FDA have just absolutely hamstrung the American policy response to coronavirus at every stage, not because they're malicious, not because they are trying to do evil, but just because they are a big, bloated, slow-moving bureaucracy that doesn't know how to change and is terrible at responding to crisis situations. And, you know, just to go back to your point that the UK has approved this vaccine, it's not just that they have approved this. It's that if you live in England or Scotland, the vaccine is going to start rolling out tomorrow. Tuesday of this week, people will be getting the vaccine in England and Scotland.
Wow.
The FDA here hasn't even had the meeting yet.
If there's one takeaway from all of this, as it relates to the kind of federal government, is that you need to break down the FDA and the CDC and start over, because this is a systems problem. It's not about the individuals in the system, as Peter was pointing out. And they have acted poorly, not because they want to, but because that is the only option in the structures of the way that they were designed and are designed. And unfortunately, you know, that probably won't happen because these are also, you know, their failings are not because of who was president or not. It's just, it's baked into how they operate. And this is where, you know, we're 20 years into the 21st century, and we're using regulatory apparatuses that are so clunky and worn out. I mean, this is the equivalent of a leisure suit. You know, it's just like, get rid of it, burn it, and start over.
Just going to have to be a conscientious objector to any bad words about leisure suits on this podcast, Nick. You could do that on
Matt.
The Wednesday Reason interview. That's fine.
We spend most of our time just talking you down, Matt, so we don't get into fashion very much, but we can make a special appearance.
To Nick's point about who's president, I would even go further to that, which is to say that Donald Trump, more than just about any recent president that I can think of, has targeted the bureaucracy at the FDA, has mentioned it in, I think, two different or maybe all of his State of the Union addresses as we need right to try. We need to speed up the process so that sick people. He had, one of his Lenny Skutniks was someone who was able to use an experimental drug.
It was featured a couple of times at the RNC.
At the RNC, too, you know, he launched Operation Warp Speed, or the administration did under his name. So imagine a motivated president who, faced with this, is like taking rhetorical and actual action. And still we have this. It speaks to me that, you know, we often try to soft pedal the ill intent, or, you know, describe accurately the lack of objectively ill intent. At some point, like, the ill effects are there. So I don't care if, yeah, you know, a lot of commies claim to have good intent and they created gulags, so they can
walking this process. We should probably just like lay it out because it's worth examining, is that the FDA in its gatekeeper role confers legitimacy on drugs like this, and that what they're job is not just to ascertain scientifically whether it is safe, but to make the public case and to reassure the public that it is safe. And so as a result, the argument goes, and again, I'm not saying this is my argument, but as the argument goes, they want to almost sort of like make it look like they're taking more time in order to bring people on board with the virus and create a kind of a public acceptance of this. I mean, Fauci has basically said this, you know, that the FDA, his quote was, really scrutinizes the data very carefully to guarantee to the American public that this is a safe and efficacious vaccine. I think if we did any less, we would add to the already existing hesitancy on the part of many people because they're concerned that we went too quickly. And look, it's true. There are people who are worried about this vaccine who think that this process has moved too fast. But I think we're in a bad place if the FDA, an organization as incompetent and inept and sort of, as Nick said, not modern, right? Like they just haven't updated their processes. They don't really think like a modern biotech firm. They're really stuck in the past in a lot of ways. And if an organization that is so consistently bad at its job and doesn't really know how to think about the modern medical environment is the gatekeeper and is in charge of getting the public on board, then that's a real problem, and it's a bad place to be. And I also just think that it's a bad way to think about the FDA's role, because the FDA, in some ways, may confer some sort of a legitimacy or authority to some people, but it's also very clear that for a lot of people, it doesn't. And that is a way of saying that we can't trust people to make these decisions on their own, and that we have to have a giant government bureaucracy do it for them.
I'll also point out that, you know, one of the co-chairs of Biden's COVID task force is David Kessler, who's a former FDA commissioner back in the 90s. And he was one of the worst offenders in both trying to expand the reach of the FDA, as well as just clogging up every possible move forward. He is a archetypal bureaucratic busybody who just gums things up. So we have that to look forward to.
I also wanted to hit even briefly that today, I guess last night, we found out President-elect Joe Biden's nominee to head up the Health and Human Services And it's Javier Becerra of California, who replaced Kamala Harris as the attorney general in the Golden State. And as someone who he's been in public office in California since I was in high school, I believe, just assembly assistant to this DA or that attorney general, Congress for 1,000 years. And now he's attorney. If this is a sign of how like we're back to a government of experts, baby, no, you're back to a Democratic Party controlled by someone who's a Democratic Party lifer, who's moving chess pieces around, including Becerra was supposed to be on the short list of being the person appointed to the U.S. Senate to replace Kamala Harris. And maybe people didn't like that because they have this thing about him. He's nobody's COVID expert at all. He's a busybody, nuisance lawsuit filing Democratic lifer in California who is unexceptional in every variety. And Peter, I know you have at least one good conspiracy theory about him before we pivot to video.
I don't think that's a conspiracy theory. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has been under legal challenge basically since the day it was passed into law. And this pick suggests that Biden views the role of HHS chief not as sort of medical job, not even as a kind of health policy job, but instead as a legal defender of the Affordable Care Act and other health laws in court. And he's being picked. I think this is at least the suggestion in the New York Times write-up, as well as the Wall Street Journal, that he is being picked because he is going to be at the forefront of making the legal case for the Affordable Care Act in the Biden administration.
Let's go towards just a couple of extra runoff webathon questions from you, dear listeners, that we didn't have time to get to in our 85-minute special webathon roundtable. Just a couple. One was directed at Catherine from Mark Wenning. Can we see your Thanksgiving Cranberry Man?
I tweeted Cranberry Man. So you can go check out my Twitter feed, which is just K. Bangie Ward, and see him in all of his glory. It was a particularly janky one this year, as befits 2020. Uh-huh. The hair was made of chives, and there were like 7 hairs. So it really had like a Matt Welsh Corona hair vibe, to be quite honest. There was a mullety situation going on.
I don't know what you're talking about. But.
And I also want to note that Cranberry Man is breaking out. We got some retweets and follow-ups from people who built their own Cranberry Men. I expect Thanksgiving 2021 to be the year of the Cranberry Man.
H.P. Lovecraft, I've seen this image, and H.P. Lovecraft had absolutely nothing on Cranberry Man. Like, there truly no horror in the world is greater.
Catherine, if I can suggest, since you know we've had to cancel Lobster Girl.
Oh, R.I.P. Lobster Girl.
Oh my God,
man! R.I.P. Lobster Girl. If you could insert Cranberry Man into your final webathon post, I think a grateful nation would respond.
It seems kind of niche. Maybe you could insert Cranberry Man into the post associated with this podcast. You put my tweet in there. I think that's the right approach.
I was actually impressed by what Cranberry Man looked like. Your descriptions of it left me much, much more worried than what I saw.
You were relieved.
I applaud Cranberry Man. I hope to create that institution.
I was
in
trying
my
to think, like, can we make
gather.
Like a principled case for, because this is like deeply frivolous. And I think the principled case for Cranberry Man is this. Are you ready? We live in a society that is so wealthy, that has such an incredible abundance of industrial food that we can literally play with our food. Like, that used to be an admonition by parents. Don't play with your food, because food was expensive. It was a huge part of a family's budget, and it was a matter of life or death for a huge number of families to have enough food to eat. Now, we are so wealthy, we can take our weird artificial canned cranberry product and turn it into art.
We live in a society. I thought you were an anarchist, Catherine. J.D. Brennan asks, and I'll throw it to Nick first, what are the negative consequences of the increasing debt? I will add also, as the bonus question that all libertarians should be looking at is, like, where's my sweet inflation, bro?
Yeah. I think the primary effect of massive ongoing increases in debt is reduced economic growth. And there will eventually be some kind of inflation or, you know, devaluing of the dollar, cuts in government services, increases in taxes. That will come eventually, but the timing might be, you know, it might be 10 years, it might be 20 years, whatever. But again and again, both kind of market-friendly and non-market-friendly economists agree that having debt at the general levels that we have it at tends to reduce economic growth by about 1 percentage point a year, typically from about 3% a year to about 2% a year. We're actually under that for most of the 20th century when you average things out. And it fits in very neatly with the theory that massive spending begets lower and slower economic growth. And we've seen that.
Peter, anything to add as a debt hater?
Leaves us less prepared for a crisis. I mean, if you want to make the case, and again, this is not one that I necessarily agree with, but I think, you know, there's a sort of centrist economic perspective that says that in times of economic crisis, that's when you want to pass, you know, stimulus bills. That's when you want to put government money into the economy to sort of get through difficult times. If you want to do that, then you are much less prepared for those moments of crisis when they come, as they occasionally do, as we have seen this year, if you have already very high debt and deficit levels. And it means also just like to liberals, this is the thing that I say to liberals, and it used to be something that liberals kind of understood. And again, it's not exactly my perspective, but I think it's one that's worth keeping in mind, is that if you have very high debt and deficit levels, what happens is that the programs that you care about, the government programs that you care about, end up under threat. And you can't sustain them unless you can, in some sense, keep them paid for. And we are about to see that with big entitlements over the next 15 years or so. Medicare, it's crazy. I keep looking at the calendar and we keep getting closer to 2026. It's really not very far away. Joe Biden could still be president in 2026. And Medicare, one of the big trust funds, is going to be insolvent in 6 years.
The other thing I'll add is that it allows, from a libertarian point of view, by doing everything via borrowed money, it also increases the size of government because people are not paying the full freight, the cost of government. And there's some economic research that suggests when you have tax increases, when the cost of government goes up, people respond like they do in every other instance. When prices go up, all things being equal, they buy less of something. There's, you know, if we are borrowing 30 cents on every dollar that the government is spending or whatever it is at whatever point in time, you're kind of a schmuck if you don't say like, okay, let's get a lot more of this. It's government by Groupon, and it allows for people to, you know, get more, you know, it's a service you don't want, but it's like, well, it's cheaper. You know, that's another big problem with deficit funded government.
All right, let's go to our end of show. Oh, just a reminder, thank you again, all you who've donated for the webathon. Go to reason.com/donate to do that. Runs out on Tuesday at midnight. It's just great and fun, and thank you. Let's go to our end of round table, what you have been consuming. I'm going to start, mostly to preempt anyone else from using this one. I watched just last night the new documentary by Alex Winter called Zappa, about Frank Zappa, who's a very kind of culturally important, if not billion-selling, musical artist and personality, whose world has overlapped with libertarian worlds, as has Alex Winter's, probably more so over the years. And he's a musician, I hasten to add, whose music I've never liked at all, except for a couple of ribald ditties that ended up on the great Dr. Demento program when I was growing up. but
again, with Dr. Demento,
never
MA.
Enough Dr. Demento, yeah. In leisure suits. No, it's the favorite movie I've seen in a really long time. Granted, you know, it's about kind of rock music and in its own way, Southern California. It's a very difficult subject in terms of there's so much to kind of consume. Winter got access to the family's, to Zappa's vault, which he meticulously kept. And one of the great themes of it, of the piece, is that from the beginning, Zappa insisted on understanding on a fundamental level that music has to be taken care of as a business, because he wanted to pay for his compositions to be realized. He was an obsessive, like a composer, kind of a jerk to people around him. Just writing all the time. You never really get down to the mystery of what drove him, almost like in terms of madness. But his sense of independence and owning his own stuff, including his own record label, is basically why and how. And the documentary is good on this. He ended up being the kind of poster child for sticking up for free expression in the face of ridiculous congressional hearings by the Parents Music Resource Center and other people in the mid to late 1980s. You know, it could have been Prince. They were going after Prince. It could have been all kinds of heavy metal people, but all those guys had like contracts and relationships with major labels. Zappa's like, I can do what I want, so I'm going to stick up for this. And there's other stuff in there about brushes with the law that I didn't know or had forgotten about, that are really interesting. So very, very much enjoyed it. Won't necessarily be for everyone, but even if you don't like Frank Zappa's music, which I don't, you will, I think, take a, there's plenty to take away from it as well. Nick, you want to go?
Matt, he's the, you know, he's the only reason I don't eat yellow snow to this day.
Yes, yes.
yeah, he's fascinating because I, like you, I find him really genuinely interesting and also prescient as a culture creator. I don't particularly care for his output, but the way he conducted his, you know, his life and insisting on ownership and self-expression is like incredibly inspiring.
Yeah, and the breadth of it was much more than yeah. I mean, it's like doing really interesting greeting cards in the mid '60s right. for no particular reason.
Alex Winter is also a phenomenal documentarian. People will know him most from Lost Boys as an actor and Bill and Ted's the Bill and Ted series, but he has put out, you know, half a dozen fantastic documentaries. Not a libertarian, but very libertarian adjacent on yep. many issues, and I recommend going back and looking at some of his previous documentaries, things like Download and whatnot. They're quite good.
What have you been consuming, Nick?
And this sounds a little bit odd, but I think it's relevant for the Webathon week. I actually, over the weekend, I spent time with the print edition of Reason Magazine. And the most recent issue, which is the January 2021 issue, Will City Survive, refreshed my memory of just what a wonderful thing a magazine is. And Catherine, this is, you know, certainly polishing your effort here. What a fantastic collection of articles in the January 2021 issue. There's a cover story by Christian Britschke about whether or not cities will survive, which talks, it's the best thing that I've seen about what was ailing cities before COVID, what might ail them later, and also what might help them, and more generally urban areas. There's a great Peter Bagg cartoon about Milton Friedman and Chile. You haven't seen anything like this before. Mike Riggs has a fantastic piece about why Singapore is not a model for a more libertarian America, which you sometimes hear because it's kind of an anarcho. I mean, if you opted in, it would be kind of like a super rule-bound state. Jacob Solom talking about getting rid of a bunch of, you know, asset forfeiture and other ugly things that cops do. I have an interview in there with Ira Glasser, the former executive director of the ASLU, who is just fantastic on speech. He took over the organization just after, or as it was defending Nazis marching in Skokie. He's just wonderful. There's Lenore Scanese. There's so much good stuff in this issue. I've been reading Reason Magazine as a magazine. And Catherine, help me out here. What's the current subscription cost for a year?
Definitely super cheap. I think we've got like some $15 like, type offers out there. So
yeah.
come and get it, babies.
Yeah. And if you you can get a digital edition if you give, I think it's $100 in the Webathon, which is great. But really, the paper, you know, the paper edition is just, it's a wonderful thing. It's a work of beauty because of that physicality And our art director, Joanna Andreasen, is just marvelous at this. It's a really good kind of weird guilty pleasure, which I, you know, when I left the editing the print magazine and moved into kind of cyberspace and video, I kind of lost touch with literally and figuratively with print magazines. And it was a really wonderful thing to spend a couple hours with.
Catherine, do you want to bask in the glow and also talk about what you've been
doing? Sure. I mean, I love Reason, Reason Editor at Large praises Reason Magazine, but I have this feeling too, actually, because
sometimes
you finish the magazine, takes a while to print and ship it. And so by the time it arrives, you're like, oh, what's in this guy? And you're like, oh, these articles are pretty good. It is, in fact, $15. And if I may say, makes a great Christmas gift. Consider it as a stocking stuffer. You can give a gift subscription to your nearest and dearest. I think I may have actually mentioned that I was reading this earlier on the pod, but I finished Klotzvog, which is a Russian novel by a woman named Margarita Kemlin. And it is a very Russian novel-y Russian novel in that things happen that are bad for no reason and everyone suffers. But it's actually a very
that's a very 2020 novel.
It's also a very 2020 novel. So it's a very interesting read. It's a very personal novel. It's written in a kind of it's not stream of consciousness, but it's just kind of a straight single narrator telling you her perception of her life, but barely alluded to, but totally present in this book is the fact that she lived through World War II and then life in the Soviet Union as a Jew. And so there's this long story about kind of her personal doings, and she's always trying to kind of fix things and set things up for herself and scrambling for a better apartment or a better husband or a better whatever. But it's against the background of these enormous, tyrannical, geopolitical forces that are acting on her and totally warping who she is as a person. And so I guess that's the reason I want to recommend it here is, like, if you want a novel about what it is like to live in a dysfunctional state that is in no way a political novel. This is a deeply personal narrative. But her, you know, ultimately the things that make her kind of what it seemed to me was like a horrifying character. The main character's name is Maya. She's horrifying because she has to survive in a state that wants to kill her and her people and has already killed so many of her and her people. And that's worth thinking about. That's worth, like, taking a minute with and thinking about, how does the state that you live in make you who you are? And when is the state culpable for making people into bad people, or at least into self-absorbed people, which is what this is ultimately a novel about. So Klotzvog, if you want to feel depressed this holiday season, I recommend it.
Sold. Suderman, what have you been
before consuming? I get to my what you're consuming, I just want to piggyback on Nick's recommendation, in specific of the cover story by Christian Britschke, Will Cities Survive? And I want to make a short webathon pitch to everyone. That story took months to produce. Christian started working on it over the summer. And it's a great, great piece, just like a really smart kind of expansive treatment of the issue, of the history of how epidemics and public health have always changed and shaped the way our cities are designed and how that is continuing to happen today. I mean, he talked to a ton of people, did a huge amount of kind of background reading, and he just does this great job of organizing and contextualizing all of the kind of changes to urban life that we are seeing now. But a story like that isn't something that can be produced in an hour or an afternoon. They just take a lot of time to produce and a lot of effort. And I feel constantly incredibly lucky to work at someplace that supports producing long form, thoughtful magazine journalism like that. And to be able to work with people like Christian on stories like those. But But they take time and they take effort. And that is what your Webathon donations end up supporting. So that said, I will just tell you that I have been spending the last couple of weeks consuming small screen Star Wars things. So both The Mandalorian, which is the series that is on Disney Plus, but also Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, which is a video game that came out just last year. And both of them are like giving me hope in Star Wars again after a couple of years of really thinking, ah, did J.J. Abrams and Disney just completely ruin this? And what both of these small screen stories do is they recognize that Star Wars isn't just a narrow little narrative about a couple of people named Skywalker or maybe not named Skywalker. It's a giant world that is interconnected. And it does such a great job of just of telling stories that exist within the Star Wars world, but are not sort of part of the main Skywalker narrative. Both of them do just connect in really interesting ways. And The Mandalorian in particular this season has done some really fun and smart stuff connecting with the animated series that were run by Dave Filoni, the Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels, and bringing back characters who have never appeared, bringing back and raising up characters who have never appeared in live action. Dave Filoni is a like a deep fan and a true fan of Star Wars, but also somebody who just kind of who's a good storyteller. And the Clone Wars was 160 episode rescue of the George Lucas prequels it didn't just understand what was good about the prequels. It actively made them better and more interesting in retrospect. And you can kind of see him gearing up to do the same thing with the J.J. Abrams and Rian Johnson trilogy here. But it's just it's a reminder of how much fun Star Wars is, of how expansive it is, of how like delightfully kind of weird it can be. And also just how small and timid and visionless the Disney trilogy was, and how much Disney left on the table by not going a different route.
I'm looking forward to when they finally get around to exploring the Cantina Band and who was the Frank Zappa of the Cantina Band, orchestra leader who was ripping off his members and kicking them out. And I just think that'll be great.
Yeah,
I have to say, for whatever reason, after having gone into a full deep hibernation during most of your suggestions, the words Cantina Band like revived me. And if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about me, I don't know what will.
Isn't it amazing that Star Wars, like, you know, Peter, when you talk about like, so, you know, of the original movies, like maybe a third of them are any good. Like everybody hates basically 2/3 of them. And it might vary a little bit, but it's.
I think this is completely wrong. I find the first
you're
two.
You're just talking about like so the three prequels,
the first
suck,
two
right?
Star Wars films, really yeah. excellent.
That's a French
and there's
goodbye
a lot
right
of good
there.
Material in.
You
Return
just
of the Jedi.
Were spending your time talking about how all of the it had to be rescued, you know, and the Disney movies suck.
Oh, sure.
You know, I'm saying of the core movies, it's hilarious that the genius and the kind of ethos of Star Wars. I mean, I find this genuinely amazing that it continues to surpass the shitty execution of the vast majority of the stuff that makes up the Star Wars universe. That's all.
Again, in part because the franchise has never just been the movies, right? If you go back even to the late 80s and 1990s, you had all of these expanded universe novels. People took the idea of Star Wars not as a kind of a straight line narrative about a handful of characters.
It's a matrix.
But
it's a universe.
This gigantic, crazy
it's a
world
sandbox.
That you could play around in. And
the Star
and
Trek is like that too.
And it's such a fascinating world, and the really good creators, again, like Dave Filoni, who did the cartoons, who has worked on The Mandalorian, directed one of the big episodes this season. They see that, and they see the expanse of possibility within the Star Wars universe, even if the central narrative is kind of a dud at times.
Like, I agree with you completely, and I guess this is a way of sneaking back in my love of fan fiction of things that I don't even like the original of. So, like, I really respect the Star Trek fan community that kept it alive and kept it going until it actually got good.
You know, and in particular, the Kirk Spock love fiction?
Of course. Slash fiction is the best fiction. I don't even think it's fiction. I think it's a deeper truth. But same thing with Star Wars and a lot of crappy
it's canon
Spider-Man.
In your heart.
You know, Spider-Man is like unkillable because there's something in the DNA of Spider-Man and that character in the world he inhabits that keeps exceeding the failure.
It's spider stuff in the DNA. Spider.
You can't bite. Peter, don't talk. I know Nick just said Spider-Man. That's it.
Matt, it's your like Strat-O-Matic baseball.
Don't say
it's better
word.
Than baseball.
You also don't talk.
Y'all.
You don't talk. The only person who gets to talk right now is Catherine. Say one last word about the webathon, Catherine.
I will.
The Spider-Man's webathon.
Shut up!
No,
shut
Peter,
up!
Why did you?
I'm not
do
sure
that?
Dr. Octopus really has a PhD.
Shut up!
Give us, please, give us money to keep doing Reason, and we, in exchange, will try to do our best to give you an appropriate dosage of both Suderman and Gillespie in your life going forward. We're thank you, and also we're sorry.